The last time we met, some of us in this room, we were talking about Central Asia, and I think I half promised that I was going to be in Central Asia within a month, as I had hoped I would be. But in fact, I had many other things to do, not least preparing the book, which you are now about to hear about. And as Jonathan very kindly billed me in the advertising for this, you are indeed the first people in the world to get this message. And I hope a lot of other people get it next year. It's a book about the Latin language, a language not all of you may have learnt very much about. Certainly you will not need to know Latin to understand what I'm about to say. And indeed, it might even be a bit of a distraction if you have had a proper classical education, as I did, because the nature of a classical education is to try and make you focus on the classics, a particular period, which in the case of Latin is really the 2 centuries BC and AD. Those 2 centuries together, those are the classic period for Latin. And anything written outside that period, they're inclined to say, well, it doesn't really count. They probably would allow you to slip 50 years in either direction. But there's a tendency in classical studies which goes all the way back to the way the Romans were and the Greeks were, to say that there's certain people, certain works, certain eras count, and the rest doesn't really matter. They were lesser times, lesser people, lesser writings. Well, I'm trying to revise that sort of attitude. I'm looking at Latin in the round, in the whole. As you're used to me looking at languages, I talk in centuries and millennia, not just decades or individual years. But why do I do this? The aim is to get some sort of understanding of the character of a language, and in particular, the character of Latin. What sort of language was it? What do I mean by that? Can a language indeed have a character? This is not something that one is brought up to believe as a linguist. One likes to think that any language can say anything, that by and large languages are means of getting a message across, maybe means of expressing yourself poetically. And indeed, that's the case. As you become more interested, perhaps, in literature, you think more about the character of a language, and a literary person might well say that Renaissance English has a certain character which changed in the Jacobean period. And that character of the language has something to do with what people wanted to talk about, how they wanted to express themselves, and that those sort of stylistic questions are usually held to be the domain of literature or aesthetics or something like that. But I'm trying to project those ideas onto the language itself. I think one can begin to find it plausible to look at language in this way if you think that languages, as well as being means of expression and communication, betoken an identity. They are something like the badge of a community. And of course, different human communities are different. In particular, different human communities have all had different histories. And the histories of those communities, the histories in particular of the language community, are, I think, the principal thing which creates the character of a language. Latin's history is an extremely long one. If you've been reading my book, you'll know that Greek is supposed to have had 3,000 years of documented history. Latin can't quite match that, but it can certainly lay claim to
2,500 years.
Compare that with English, which at most has been around for 1,500 years, and a little tiddling language like Spanish. Where do we think Spanish started? Canto del mio Cid, something like that. Which is a little bit actually later than Beowulf. And so, yeah, maybe maybe 1,000 years. Maybe a bit more. So, most languages that people talk about now are junior to Latin. Let's put it like that. Let me see if I can find a few pictures here. I thought it would be nice to just give a few indications of Latin's history. So what I've done is shown you, first of all, the oldest document in Latin. It is written on a strange pot, which is called the Duenos vase. And there you see it there. That is the side view. And here is the top, the view from the top. And you see it looks rather like a Wankel engine, if you see what I mean. Anyway, that is the shape. Those for the people who are listening to this recording and don't have the advantage of seeing the picture. And on this pot, which is completely unique, and nobody really has the faintest idea what it is for or why it had this strange structure, this inscription is found. Ioe sat devos quae med mitat, ne te dentochos mis vir cosied, asted noisi opetoi sia poi caribois, duenos med fecid, emanom en menom duenoin emed dumal dostad. And this is like no Latin that you have ever seen. And this is how Latin was in the 5th century BC. So that at the time that Greek was having its great era of fighting the Persians and writing all the great Greek tragedies, and the Athenians were fighting the Spartans, and Greek literature was really getting going, Latin was not yet Latin. It was going to change into something a bit more more recognizable. Since you don't know Latin, I'm not going to spend any time with this, but that Ioves sat devos there is going to change to Iurat divos, qui me domitat, etc. So he who uses me swears by the gods. Ioves sat devos, Iurat divos. And this whole thing is all going to change. It's so different from classical Latin that it is still disputed what it actually means. I've even proposed an extra innovation to the literature in this one here, which I won't go into now. But it really was different. This is in 500 BC, about the time that Rome is supposed to have expelled its kings. You may not know, in the traditional history of Rome, it goes back to 753 BC. And that was supposed to be the year in which the city of Rome was founded. And then they had kings for a long time, maybe about 250 years, and then famously they threw them out and they founded the Roman Republic. And they were very proud of that, and they hated kings ever after. And even when they got kings back again, which is what the Roman emperors really were, they always pretended they were something else. And this is everybody who does European history knows about this, but other people may not do European history. Anyway, this is the language as it was spoken just about the time that Brutus was throwing out the last kings of Rome and starting the Republic. Now, then we go through this period, which is what people think of as classical Rome, I suppose. This is a sort of lush 19th century idea of what it would have been like. But we go on and we go on, and here's a snapshot, if you like, of the late Middle Ages. We're talking here the end of the 15th century, and this picture, I believe the man in the throne in the middle is Elio Antonio de Nebrija. But he is very famous for having written the first grammar of a modern language. It was Spanish, so all credit to the Spanish for that. And this led to a great rash of writing of grammars. Quite soon afterwards, there were grammars of Italian and grammars of French and grammars of German and grammars of English. Suddenly people said, hey, you can do grammars for any language. This is one of the strange things which never seems to be pointed out, that the Greeks invented grammar in something like 3rd century BC, maybe a little bit earlier. A chap called Dionysius the Thracian is famous for having done a good job on that. And the Romans, when they conquered the Greeks, I'm going to talk about this in a minute, took on the idea of writing a grammar of Latin. And they did it. And they realized they could do it. That was in the end of the 2nd, beginning of the 1st century BC. From then until this man, that is for 1600 years, they never wrote another grammar of another language. There were only two grammars which had language with grammars. They knew that. It was Greek and Latin. Nothing else counted. This man had the great insight that actually all grammars, all languages could be looked at in that way. But what I've shown you his picture here just to give you an idea, perhaps, of a medieval schoolroom. He's really the last of the medievals, in that the sort of medieval spirit lived on perhaps a little, a century or so later in Spain, where he lived, than it did in other parts of Europe. And, of course, this is one of the things which Cervantes focuses in on, because he's focusing on the sort of medieval obsessions of the Spaniards in writing Don Quixote. Anyway, but then here we are, and I've jumped right to the end of the Latin period here, and this is a bit of Mexican Latin, all right? This is describing a strange device. I don't know any of you have been to the Ethnographic Museum in Mexico City. I have, and I have seen this done. Basically, these guys climb up to the top of a very high pole, get into this mechanism here, tie themselves onto these ropes, and swing out. And centrifugal force makes them swing right out into circles, and they go faster and faster and faster, and then they slow down as they come to the bottom, and they all end up perfectly happily on the floor. These are called the volantes, and it's one of the great, you could say, technical triumphs or games of the Aztecs. And here is a Mexican Jesuit, Rafael Landivar, writing about it in the late 18th century. And this was really about the end of the time that anyone anywhere was writing creatively in Latin. Okay, but it's interesting that really the last gasp of Latin comes not in Europe at all, but in the New World, in Mexico, and also to some extent in the United States. So anyway, they had this very long history. What do we really want to say about Latin and its character? I'm looking for the Latin mindset, if you like, and I find it in a phrase that I'm going to use as the title of the book, which is ad infinitum, or ad infinitum. I've discovered, sadly, that nobody who is in your generation has ever seen this phrase, even if they are English or American, so I'm wondering if it's going to be a very successful title. Nevertheless, ad infinitum means for on and on forever. All right, it's the Latin for that. But it means to the infinite, to the unbounded. And finis, you see, finis means an end or a boundary. So this is without a boundary. And what I want to say about is characteristic of the Latin way of looking at the world is that it is unbounded in all directions. Not only that, but we own it. The idea is that You always come across this in descriptions of the ancient world. The whole world was under Roman control. When Augustus finally resolved the Roman civil wars at the end of the 1st century BC, he had a nice slogan which he put on his coins, Pax Orbis Terrarum. This, of course, is the word peace. This is Orbis, means literally circle, or sphere, I suppose, and of lands. So this is something like peace in the circle of lands, and the normal word for the whole world in Latin is Orbis Terrarum. So he basically said, I have restored peace to the world. Don't worry about Persia, don't worry about Germany, don't worry about Africa. The world has been sorted out. And, of course, if the world is a circle has a center, and guess where the center was? The center, of course, is Rome. Let's see if I've got that here conveniently. Yes! Now, this is it's quite interesting, actually, seeing how the Romans viewed their world. We are familiar with maps of the Mediterranean, which have Italy looking like a large boot with a heel in the middle of it, and Spain as a sort of rectangular block on the left-hand side, etc. Now, the Romans controlled all this area. I mean, as I was once moved to see my stepson realize, he was about 10 or 11 at the time, he said, the Roman Empire was bigger than any of our countries now, wasn't it? And it is actually amazing when you think about it, with what they had. You know, all they had was swords and roads and horses and armies and a bit of papyrus. They were able to... and aqueducts too, when they got there. But I don't think that enabled them to control the... But here, fair enough. They did a lot with what they had, I agree. So, nevertheless, they did all that, but they, in some sense, they had a very strange idea of what they had achieved. Because, of course, they never had a chance to having a view. They didn't have ocean-going navigation, which was really when we started to have ocean-going navigation, people started to produce accurate maps of the world. Before that, we had something like this. This is the only map which seems to have survived from the ancient world. It's called the Tabula Peutingeriana because of some German called Peutinger held it at some stage. But it seems to be a copy of a map which would have been made in something like the 2nd century AD. So it's really very old. And that is it. Now, can you see... Trouble is, you may not be familiar with the ancient place names, but you probably know Italia. Look, here's Italy. Instead of going down the map, it's going across the map from left to right, and here is the little boot heel at the end, all right? There's Sicily. You see that? Somewhere over there, behind Italy, is Greece. Okay, well, Illyricum is what we now, what we used to call Yugoslavia. Here's the same area here. It's very, very long and thin. And there's Greece there. You see, it's sort of been squashed round that way. At the bottom here, this whole landmass at the moment, it's rather similar to our modern maps in that that is the coast of Africa. Nobody had the faintest idea what was the rest of Africa, so they didn't need to do the bottom of Africa at all. Here's Spain, Hispania. And look how close Britain is to Spain in this concept. In fact, this was actually made into a sort of pun. This is, look next to Britannia. What do you think this is? This is Ireland, okay? But they called that Hibernia, and they called this one Hiberia. And they thought how very natural it would be because Ireland is right next door to Spain. And if you read Isidore's Encyclopedia of Current Knowledge, which was written in the 5th century AD and was very, very popular. Another Spaniard, Seville, Isidore of Seville he was.
Isidorus Hispalensis. He said actually Ireland was populated from Spain, he thought. Which may have been true, but not for the reason that he thought it was. Anyway, as you will see if you read my book, the previous book, there are reasons for thinking that Ireland was indeed populated from Spain, but linguistic reasons. Anyway, here's Britain, here's Gaul, which is now France, of course, Gallia, Germany, and maybe you can work out some of this other stuff. Here is what is now Turkey. Here's the Holy Land. So if you look at early medieval maps, of course, this is the most important place in the world because Jerusalem is there. But this is a 2nd century AD map, which is pre-Christian. Jerusalem had yet to express its importance. And here we are. Here's all the bits of the world which don't matter at the end. Okay, Scythia, that would be equivalent to modern Ukraine, parts of Russia. India's over there. Persia's here. They're all tiny. Because, so in a way, this gives you some idea of why the Romans it's a map of the Roman mind, in a way, this map. A few more other little nuggets. When Antoninus Pius, who was supposedly one of the great emperors, and he was in the 2nd century AD now, so this is quite late, and they supposed to have a golden age. Basically, the British historian Gibbon thought that this was the golden age of the Roman Empire, and so people tend to have a very good impression of this emperor and others of the same period, like Hadrian, you may possibly have heard of, or Hadrianus, and Marcus Aurelius. We tend to see him a lot because he's always at the beginning of films about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, the idea being that things got worse after him. Commodus was the son. And those of you who have seen, tell me the name of the film I'm thinking of, Gladiator, will have seen Marcus Aurelius, who was one of these guys, and the end of his era. But anyway, Antoninus Pius, who was one of these three noble emperors, put on his coins, in an act of typical Roman modesty, Dominus Totius Orbis, which you can imagine means Lord of all the world. So people knew where they stood. It's a little bit like what used to be said about the British Empire in the 19th century. Now, those of you who live in parts of the ex-British Empire may even be familiar with this. It was called the Empire on which the sun never sets. And an Indian, I think it was, wit reminded, yes, because God doesn't trust the British in the dark. These sort of ideas of grandeur have a way of falling to pieces, but the story of Latin is in a way the story in which that idea fell to pieces, but it took an awful long time. It took about 1,500 of those 2,500 years we talked about for the sun to set on the concept of the world being the Latin world. In a way, the Romans had got the idea from the Greeks, because as we've mentioned in our language history course, the Greeks had a very good idea of themselves, a very high idea of themselves. They thought that their world was the inhabited world, oikoumene, you may remember that. And so when the Romans said, okay, you own the oikoumene, but we own you, and furthermore, we have other bits of the world as well, which, of course, aren't as good as you are, but nevertheless, they belong to us too. So, of course, the Italians came and they took charge of Greece, and it turned out that the people that they conquered in Greece had considerable power in this part of the world as well. So in conquering Greece, Rome found itself almost in control of Asia Minor as well, and then Syria, within a couple of generations. So they said, all right, well, you own that, but we own you.
And we want to be like you. It was exactly like the Jungle Book. You know, we want to walk like you, talk like you. And that's what they did. They did their best to absorb as much Greek culture as they could. And the result is that the history of the Roman Empire is the history of Greco-Roman culture. They got a lot from the Greeks, and the Greeks got a lot from the Romans, although they lost their independence, and in some sense they lost power. But they gained a vast world influence. So what about everybody else? The fact is that they didn't really seem to count. There were these Gauls, who had been the major power in northern Europe. They were conquered in parts, in different parts. The most important a period of conquest was Caesar's in the 1st century BC, I think famously from 59 to 49 BC. He was conquering what has now become northern and central France. And so in a way you could say the French language is due to that one man. He sort of created the basis for the French language. And the Gauls within a few generations of being conquered by the Romans were giving up speaking Gaulish. Okay, they had had a very lively but non-written culture of their own based on Druids. And we know from inscriptions and some of the artwork they left that they must have had an extremely elaborate mythology as well, because you can see these strange things, people with antlers on their heads running around with little golden cups and doing things, and you realize it doesn't make sense unless there is a story here. But we don't know the story. We don't know the story because they didn't write it down. The Druids didn't want to write it down because they thought real culture should be in your head. And the people who conquered them never had enough interest, it seems, to want to write it down. We get occasional little bits and pieces from Greeks who were traveling in the West and thought, oh, this is quite interesting stuff. And it's clear that they were a very oral culture, but they never wrote it down, and so essentially it's lost. Other people, like the Germans, were never conquered at all. In fact, the Romans decided that it was a waste of effort, in some sense, to try and conquer the Germans. That may not have been because they thought they were impossible to beat militarily. It may have been an economic decision, because every Roman province very much paid its way. There was a stream of wealth coming from every province after it was conquered, except possibly with the exception of Britain. Britain seems to have been conquered for prestige purposes, and they always rather regretted it. Until, strangely, in something like the 3rd or 4th century AD, just as the empire was beginning to fall to pieces, Britain seemed to, possibly because the weather improved or something, they had a good period, Britain became a breadbasket, and they were glad they had it for that last 3rd century AD. But in general, the Romans avoided conquering places which didn't seem to be very wealthy. And they just didn't count. And, of course, the people beyond the Germans, like the Scythians, which we've got here, I don't know whether you've got the Sarmatians, yes, those would be in places like Bulgaria, I guess. They didn't count either because they didn't have anything the Romans wanted. In particular, they didn't have any wealth. Egyptians, they did want. They conquered those. And, indeed, for a little while, after the conquest of Egypt, which was really due to Julius Caesar, the Romans used to play at being Egyptian pharaohs. But, of course, they sort of wore off after a time. They couldn't be bothered with it. And Egyptian culture died out pretty much at the same time as the rise of Christianity. Now, I'm spending far too long on everything, and we're only in the ancient world. What I'm going to say, then, is just to skip forward with this idea of ad infinitum, this idea that we are the world, we control the world. You can see it coming up again and again over this period of 2,500 years. So I've already mentioned that
Latin was the only language to absorb Greek grammar until dear Antonio de Nebrija had the idea that actually Spanish is just as good as Latin, and we're going to have a grammar for Spanish too. And that was a great step forward, regardless of what his motives were in having the idea. When the Roman Empire fell in the West, it's interesting that this wasn't because people wanted to get rid of Roman domination. We are familiar with the collapse of world empires in the 20th century, and it would be fair to say that a large part of the motivation for that was that the people who were being ruled said, actually, we don't want to be ruled anymore, and they made it impossible for themselves to be ruled. That didn't happen ever with the Roman Empire. The reason the Roman Empire fell, insofar as it did fall, in the West, was because it was essentially swamped by immigrants. People wanted to come in. They wanted to be part of the empire. Now, I want to have a part of that. No, you can't come in. Sorry, no, we can't cope with everyone. No, we're going to come in anyway. And that's what they did. And this is basically what the Germans did. And if you read the texts of the 5th century AD, a lot of them are saying, well, you shouldn't really be so frightened of these barbarians because they just want to be like us. And they have a funny way of showing it by fighting us to get in, but that's what they really want to do. And indeed, it was the case that when the Goths actually managed to take control of Rome, the first thing they did was they turned around and said, ah, but look, there are these Vandals coming to invade Spain. We'd better deal with them. And so they immediately rushed off round through southern Gaul and defeated the Vandals in Spain. And so the Vandals had a hard time. They did somehow managed to hang on to Vandalusia, but they basically said, all right, we'll better leave Spain behind. We'll go to North Africa. And they took over North Africa for 200 years. So that was one thing. So the point is that not only that the Romans thought that they were the world, everybody around them agreed. Yes, you are. Yes, we'd like to be like you. And then, of course, the next thing that came on a little bit before, actually, the fall of the empire was the spread of Christianity. Christianity, to start with, saw Romans as evil. All right, they were the ones, well, they weren't quite as evil as the Jews, but they had crucified Christ, and he hadn't done anything as far as the Christians were concerned. And then, usually, when people were martyred in the early years of the church, it was by the Roman civil authority. And so Christianity was not pro-Roman for the first 200 years, but somehow they managed, and they were persecuted quite strongly now and again by the Romans. But for political reasons, really, it seems, the Emperor Constantine in the 4th century AD chose to say, I am fighting under the sign of Christ. All right. So he was fighting another contender for the imperial throne, and this chap had said, I've got the Sibylline books on my side. And so he said, well, I've got to have something myself. So he said, all right, well, we've got Christians on our side, all right, because his mother had been Christian. He thought, all right, we'll do that. And things took over, and the Christians very much took the opportunity which offered to them, and late in life, Constantine became a Christian. It was very common in those days, for some reason, for people to get baptized at the end of their lives rather than at the beginning. Because the idea was that when you got baptized, all your sins were wiped out. So then you could get on and die, and you'd be okay. Whereas if you got baptized at the beginning, you were obviously going to sin again. Then, well, what are you going to do? You might have to confess or something, and you didn't want to do that. So that seems to be why he became an actual baptized Christian rather late. Christianity, then, was like all the other religions which came from the East, all right? Came from over here somewhere. The Romans would have thought of Palestine as being part of Syria. And it managed to spread particularly strong in Africa. And many of the early great saints, especially the ones who wrote in Latin, like Augustine and Tertullian and Lactantius, tended to live, for some reason, in Africa. So it was very strong Christian territory in something like the 5th century AD, and that was about the time that the Goths and the Vandals were coming down, and they managed to get control of the Roman government, and the result was that the faith spread particularly strongly. The interesting thing, though, was that when another reason why Latin survived so well, when you would think it wouldn't, when the Germans invaded, okay, the Goths came into Italy, and the Vandals and the Alans came into Spain, and the Franks came into France, and the Angles and Saxons came into Britain. All this was going on at the same time. And by and large, they came and they stayed. And the kingdoms that we now have in Western Europe are pretty much descendants of those Germanic kingdoms. Well, why did Latin survive? Why didn't they spread their Germanic languages? I mean, we know they did in England, and we've discussed that ad nauseam, probably, in the course of our discussions earlier this year. But in the rest of the world, Latin ultimately hung on. Partly it was because there weren't that many Goths and Germans and Vandals who came. But there had never been, to start with, there hadn't been that many Romans going round the world, and they managed to change the world to their language. What does seem to have been important, though, was that by this stage, the Roman Catholic Church had adopted Latin as its language of liturgy. So anybody who was a Roman Catholic Christian was singing and giving praises and doing prayers in Latin every day, or at least once a week. The Goths were Christians too. They were Arians, okay? They had a slightly different view of theology, which made Jesus less divine. But in principle, they were Christians, and they had the Bible translated into Gothic. They had their services in all over Europe. But as it happened, one by one, the Arian churches either were associated with Germanic powers who were defeated, or were converted to become Roman Catholics. And in a way, the triumph of Latin over the Germanic languages in early Europe is the triumph of Roman Catholicism over Arianism. We never hear about Arianism now. I mean, I've had to sort of dredge it up for myself over the last few months while I was teaching you on my off days. But this is what happened. Arianism was an extremely strong religion, but because it's gone, people don't hear about it anymore. All right, well, that's one thing. So Christianity, therefore, you see, is another of these organizations who comes to say, we are the world. You know, we've got the whole world as ours. And, of course, now they're associated with the Romans again. The Romans can go on saying, we are the world. Now, it's interesting that when you look at the development of thinking during the Middle Ages, there was an awful lot of work on theology, etc. The development of intellect depended, to start with at least, on getting access to classical texts, so that people they didn't have faith that they were capable of developing ideas for themselves. They felt they had to read what they call the auctores, which basically means the authors, and those were the great classical authors like Cicero and Virgil and people like that, but they were also the great Christian authors like Augustine. So the auctores were the authors. And of course, what auctores have is auctoritas. So authors, this is the word which in English has ultimately come out as authors, they had authority. And an awful lot of knowledge was lost in the course of the barbarian invasions and gradually was brought back again. Part of it, as you probably know, was brought back rather late through translations from the Muslim world and also from, that's from this sort of area, Africa, and a bit of it also in Hispania, because there were lots of Muslims in Hispania in those days, in Spain. But when they developed ideas, what they would like to do is
to express them in a document called a summa. And in a way, the summa is the intellectual equivalent of this geographical idea of Pax Orbis Terrarum. As to say, is you get a subject, say, grammar, or philosophy, or astronomy, and you write a summa of it. That is like a summary. It is an ordered expression of what is known in that subject, full stop. All right? So it's not like modern scientific subjects, which are always thought to be open-ended, and that, you know, we will write a textbook as far as we know at the moment, but you, when you go along and do your research, you will find that there's more stuff to be learned. And so that is the characteristic view of the modern world. The characteristic view of the Roman medieval intellectual world is that you can write a summa and that a good scholar will be able to sum up an expression. It's interesting, the word summa, obviously it's related to the word summary in English, but it's also, it is the same as the word sum, and it's basically because it sums up. It means you add up everything that there is in the thing and you put it there and this is the total. All right. And why is summa, interestingly enough, if you know Latin, you'll know summa means the top. So what happened apparently, if you were a Roman, well, you obviously, you weren't using Arabic numerals, all right, so it would have been there. But when you add them up, you put it on the top. And so that's why the sum means the top. Many other things fall into this same pattern. Later on, in the last years, really, of the last centuries, one could say, of the Latin world, there was a sudden reaction against Latin as it had been preserved. This is what we have typically call the Renaissance. In the Renaissance, people said, no, we don't want to know what they were thinking and what the best people were thinking in their summae, indeed, in the last century or in the last decade. We don't want to know what Albertus Magnus had to say. We don't want to know what Peter Abelard had to say. These were all, you know, great men, but because they had been writing in the medieval tradition in this business of setting up summae, and in particular because they were had this very orderly idea of knowledge, the Renaissance people said, no, we want to know, to go back to the time when knowledge was fresh. We will go back to the classics. And the strange thing is that Europe and its knowledge renewed itself by going right back to the beginning. Rather than finding something new, they said, no, we'll just go back and take the oldest thing we know about and start again from that. And it actually turned out to work, but it was profoundly anti-scientific in its way, that it was basically the triumph of an artistic idea of what literature had been over the rather intense, serious approach, but essentially, you could say, almost constipated approach, which came from these summae. So this led to something which is now called Neo-Latin. And Neo-Latin is the sort of Latin which was used from the end of the 15th century until the 18th century. And that sort of Latin, although it's called Neo-Latin, was much less innovative, you could say, than the language which had gone before it. Neo-Latin was supposed to be based on Ciceronian Latin, all right? And Cicero was the great author of the ancient world. Strangely enough, the people who were keenest on Ciceronian Latin were the Catholics. I think what they thought was that although Cicero obviously was a pagan and he was pre-Christian, but nevertheless he was a single source who you could know where you stood with. What seems to be characteristic of, in a way, the Roman Empire, but and certainly medieval learning and the Catholic Church within that, is that they wanted something determinate. They were concerned about heresy and things like that. And the thing about someone like Cicero was that his style was clear. You could know where you stood. Anyway, this was where Latin was when the New World was discovered. The first reports we find on the New World are written by a man called Peter Martyr, who is an Italian who lived in Spain. That was convenient because he was meeting people like Christopher Columbus and Hernan Cortes face to face. And he was an Italian. He was teaching, I think he taught the royal family Latin, and he became an official historian. But he is the man who first went on record as using the word Orbis Novus, or Novus Orbis, the new world, all right? As you know, when Christopher Columbus first discovered that there was a landmass out across the Atlantic, he thought he had discovered part of India, a new way of getting to India. And he's supposed to have died in, I think, 1502, still thinking that he had just found the most easterly part of India. Strangely, not China. Because China isn't on this map. He didn't think of China being there. But by about 10 years later, people like Peter Martyr were quite clear that a new world had been found. And it's interesting that this new concept of the new world was actually a concept which was first formulated in Latin. This, however, of course, effectively is going to lead to the collapse of this world of ad infinitum being Roman. Suddenly we realize there's a great big world out there with people who know nothing about the Roman world. They haven't traded with it in the way that the Indians and the Persians and even the Chinese had done. They knew nothing about it. It was a completely new world which had to be discovered and indeed converted, as the Spanish and the Portuguese thought. So what you find rather conveniently is that when the big world is discovered, the Roman world collapses like that. And we see less and less of Latin. We've also got the fact that printing is discovered, or you could say invented, in the same period, about 50 years earlier. And the interesting thing about printing is that although all the first books to be printed were in Latin, they were printed by Germans. Printing is German technology. Gutenberg was a German. Most of the people who set up printing presses for the first 50 years all over Europe, particularly in Italy and in Spain and France, were Germans. So it was, as I put, Vorsprung durch Technik. And this was also obviously very important in that it meant that it was no longer possible to centralize the authority for knowledge. And this had various economic implications, which we've talked about, and which led to the decline of Latin. In some sense, Latin's world would, from now on, be too small. It was no longer seen as the highest world. And in a way, a nice, or rather unpleasant... Now, this is a little joke about the concept of a summa I had here. I think I'll just go back to it, since it's rather fun. This is the Bible and Christianity expressed in two rhyming lines in Latin. He whom serpent's venom fed with baleful charm, these Christ's astounding blood hath washed in balm. So, quos anguis Christi virus mulcedine pavit, hos sanguis Christi mirus dulcedine lavit. So this shows you medieval learning at its finest. All right, it's really clever stuff, all right, but perhaps it doesn't achieve very much. Anyway, it's a good example of a summa, a tiny summa indeed. This, I mentioned this early on, Rafael Landivar, he was a Jesuit, and like a number of people who wrote in Latin in Mexico in the 18th century, he was expelled because the Spanish Empire and the Spanish king decided that they didn't want to have the Jesuits in their empire anymore. they were too popular and too much under papal control, and they wanted secular control. But a spin-off effect of that was effectively to take away the Latin learning, which had been extremely prevalent and important, indeed the only intellectual tradition at the time, in the Spanish-speaking New World. So the destruction of the Jesuits in the Spanish colonies, which occurred in 1767, and perhaps for that reason tends to be ignored in Anglo-Saxon history books, because we were much more concerned about what was happening in North America at that time, and we were just about to lose our colonies at the same time as having deprived the French of theirs. So this is something that people probably need to know more about. So finally, I think we can just say that Latin survived as long as there was Europe-wide communication, as long as there was a system of transmitting the language, Latin, through the school system. Because it's very interesting that Latin survived unchanged. It survived unchanged because it became an artificial language of intellectuals. And that could not have happened if it wasn't transmitted through the schools. It survived in the church, and it survived as long as it didn't get competition from vernacular languages. Vernacular languages started to compete in the 15th century when, for the first time, people started translating things from Latin into the vernacular languages. Not surprisingly, long a little bit after that, there started to be grammars and dictionaries of those vernacular languages. People no longer thought of them as just, oh, what you might say, but this is a real language too. We mentioned that. And of course, that had a lot to do, both as cause and effect, with the rise of nationalism and the nation states, which had very little time for Latin. And when we see the beginning of the end of Latin, which had survived into the 17th century as an intellectual language, all right, so maybe if you wanted to write popular stuff, you would write in your vernacular, but certainly if you wanted to reach the whole of Europe, it was easier to write a book in Latin. What we find is that intellectuals like Descartes in France, Thomas Hobbes in England, are the first who don't think it's worthwhile writing in Latin. They write their stuff in French. Descartes wrote in French probably because most of the people he was interested in arguing with were also speakers of French. Hobbes wrote his works, such as Leviathan, this very important work in political philosophy, at the time of the English Civil War, that's in the 1640s, because that was where the great issues were. The political debates were importantly in England at the time, in the 17th century, just as in the next century with the French Revolution and so on, the focus of things had moved to France. But the fact is that the important, powerful nations in Europe started using their own languages instead of Latin, and gradually the other less important nations, the weaker nations, who wanted to stick with Latin because at least that was the same for everybody, were gradually forced to switch first into French and then latterly into English. And so I guess I will leave my account of the character of Latin with that. Thank you very much.